Well, it's good to be back with you. I said a little bit in the bulletin about the meeting, not much. Of course, it was Sunday through Wednesday night. Wednesday night, we had a young woman who was restored. They'd withdrawn from her about 2 years ago because of her living at the time. And her husband was also there. And after we were dismissed and standing around talking, then he decided he wanted to be baptized. And so we had a restoration and a baptism on Wednesday night. So that was a good ending to the meeting. It was good to end it in a way, I guess, because I started throat trouble on Sunday night, and on Monday night could hardly talk. But they had a good PA system, and I just lifted the mic right up here, and I said, "Sound man, turn it way up." And I couldn't push and holler at them like I usually do. But anyway, made it through, and we had a good trip. Got back, and I had a note from on the internet. And by the way, most of you know that Jack does all the work on our website. And it's interesting, sometimes we get communications. We just got one from a preacher out in California who had gone on it. He had a question about Sunday night communion. And I had given Jack the outline of the study that I did on Sunday night communion. And he had read it and said it had helped him. And you never know what good is going to come from that. A lot of people cruise the net. I don't that much. I do check ours once in a while, see how Jack's doing on it. But he's doing a great job on it, and we appreciate that. And I just want you to know that good is being done from that. We've been engaged in a Sunday morning series on study of God. We talked about God the Creator, and then we talked about God the God of Providence. We talked about the God of Revelation. And Sunday a week ago, we talked about God and silence. Today we're going to talk about praising God, and especially in singing. This is one way, at least, that we praise God. In John chapter 4, all of you are familiar with the woman at the well in Samaria when Jesus asked for a drink of water. He said, "Give me a drink." Of course, he was talking about water when he said, "Give me a drink." That's not what people usually think about today when they think about, "Give me a drink." But anyway, he said, "Give me a drink." And she said, "You're a Jew, and you're talking to a Samaritan woman. Jews don't have any dealings with Samaritans, especially women. And yet Jesus had violated both of those and asked her for a drink. Why? In order to engage her in a discussion of something much more important than a drink of water. He said to her, if you knew who it was that was asking you for a drink, you'd ask him, and he'd give you living water. And she said, "Boy, give me a drink of that so I won't have to come back here and draw from the well anymore." Well, that's not the kind of water Jesus is talking about. He's talking about spiritual water, and she didn't understand that. And so Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband." And she says, "I don't have one." And he said, "That's right. You've had five, and the one you're married to now, or one you're living with now, you're not even married to." She said, "Let's change the subject. Where should people worship, in Jerusalem or in Mount Gerizim?" That's interesting, isn't it? Let's change the subject. You Jews say that Jerusalem is a place to worship. Samaritans say in Mount Gerizim. Now, which is it? And Jesus then made these comments, beginning in verse 19 of the fourth chapter. Jesus said, "For the woman said, 'Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is a place where one ought to worship.' Jesus said to her, 'Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth." And so, as I said, this is a very familiar verse to all of you, I'm sure. But as I said, we're going to talk especially about praising God in worship and song this morning. Psalm has said in Psalm 30 and verse 12, "To the end that my glory may be sing praise to you and not be silent." In the 106th Psalm, verse 12, he said, "Then they believed his words, they sang his praise." And often the psalmist talks about singing praise to God. In Acts chapter 16 in the New Testament, we find Paul and Silas being in prison in Philippi. And it says at verse 25 that they at midnight they were singing and praising God in song. One translation says, "In hymn The other says they were singing praises to God. The Interlinear Bible, that's where you have the Greek text and under it the literal translation of the Greek words. And I checked on it and it said that they praising God in a hymn. So what were they doing? They were praising God in a hymn. They were singing praises to God. And they were doing that in prison. And so the Bible says a lot about singing praises to God. Now, I'm going to talk this morning basically using a book that I've used before in lessons, Old Light on New Worship. The author of it is John Price, and that's in your bulletin, by the way. His name, he's a preacher at Grace Baptist Church in Rochester, New York. And I went on the internet last night to check a little bit about Grace Baptist Church and what it is. It's called Reformed Baptist Church. They're very Calvinistic in their teaching, according to the website anyway. But anyway, he is a preacher in the Grace Baptist Church in New York. And this is the best book that I've ever read against instrumental music in worship. And that may surprise you, written by a Baptist preacher, but it is. It is an excellent book. And if you're interested in reading it and studying it, giving somebody something good to read, I'd suggest it. Anyway, on pages 21 and 22, and that's what we're going to be referring to every time I put a page number up here, he said, God has always regulated His public worship, even in regard to the specific musical instruments used. Two silver trumpets, Numbers chapter 10, verses 1, 2, 8, and 10, tells us. This was the only instrument used in public worship throughout the time of the tabernacle in the wilderness. I never had noticed this before, really, until I read his book. But anyway, in the tabernacle service during the wandering in the wilderness, before the temple was built, the priests were to blow two silver trumpets in their worship. Later in the temple, God commanded David to use instrumental music. In 2 Chronicles chapter 29 and in verses 25 through 27, it says concerning the temple, and he stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with stringed instruments, and with harps, according to the commandment of David, of Gad the king's seer, and of Nathan the prophet. For thus was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. The Levites stood with the instruments of David, and the priests with the trumpets. Then Hezekiah commanded them to offer a burnt offering on the altar. And when the burnt offering began, the song of the Lord also began with the trumpets and with the instruments of David, king of Israel. Now, we used to use, in fact, before I learned better, a lot of brethren used to use Amos chapter 6 and verse 5, where Amos said, "Woe unto them that invent themselves instruments of music like David." Well, David didn't invent those, in a sense. They were authorized of God through the prophets. David is the one, of course, that is mentioned here as being the king at the time. But anyway, they were authorized in the temple. Amos is talking about the abuse of instruments of music, where people were abusing them, using them to entertain themselves in revelry and drunkenness and all kinds of things in the context he's talking about. So Amos is not saying that David did wrong, because David was doing what was the command of the Lord. Now, Mr. Price said in his book on page 29, when the temple was to be built, its order of worship to be instituted, David received a divine revelation in regard to it, just as Moses had concerning the tabernacle. Instrumental music would not have been constituted an element of the temple worship had not God expressly authorized it by His command. And so, he is saying here, and he's referring to this, he calls it the idea of the regulative principle, is the way he referred to it. He said it's a regulative principle, that is, that there must be authority for what they did. The reason David did it, God authorized it. He wouldn't have done it had God not authorized it. Now, the same thing is true of New Testament worship. When we come to the New Testament, he said, we must again be guided by the regulative principle of worship. That simply means what we would say by authority. You have a precept, command, necessary entrance. He refers to it as a regulative principle. That is, what did God say in His Word? How did He regulate it? And so this is a regulative principle of worship. The God of the Bible has not changed, and He will still be regarded as holy by those who draw near to Him. Leviticus 10:3 and 1 Peter 1 and verse 16, which said, "I am holy, you also be holy." We must ask the question, what has God commanded in His worship? And that's a great question that people need to ask. Many people do not ask the question, what did God say about our worship? In fact, most people just say, "I like it," or "this is the way I want to do it." The Levites and the instruments in the Old Testament worship, in the temple worship, page 51, he said, God instituted the use of musical instruments as a part of the Levitical priesthood. It was the Levites alone whom He authorized to use the musical instruments. The Levitical priesthood in its entirety had been abolished. Hebrews 7, verses 11 and 12, the priesthood being changed, there's made a necessity, a change also of the law. And this must include their musical instruments. If the priesthood is abolished, then whatever was connected with the priesthood must be abolished. And who was it that played the instruments in the Old Testament worship? The priest from the tribe of Levi. Interesting. God specifically authorized the priest to play instruments of music in the Old Testament worship. No one else played it in worship. It was the priest of Levi. We do not have priests today. And therefore, when the priesthood ended, what they did also ended. The New Testament is silent about instrumental music. Page 54 of the book, Mr. Price said, musical instruments are mentioned often in the Old Testament. But what do we find in the New Testament? Nothing but complete silence. That's what we talked about 2 weeks ago. When God is silent, what does that prove? If there's no authority, you don't establish authority by what God didn't say. You establish authority by what He said. Are we to assume that there were musical instruments in the churches just as in the temple, but the Holy Spirit has forgotten to tell us about them? Not likely. And I like that, like His reasoning here. God specifically authorized instruments in the temple. He specifically authorized trumpets in the tabernacle. And if God had intended for us to have them in the church, He would have authorized them in the church. And so when God did not authorize them, that simply means that we do not have authority. What is authorized? Well, here are all the passages that mention singing. In Matthew 26 and verse 30, also in Mark 14 verse 26, it says, when they had sung a hymn, then Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns, Acts 16:25. I will sing unto your name, Romans 15 verse 9. I will sing with the spirit, I will sing with the understanding, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 15. Singing and making melody in your heart, Ephesians 5:19. Singing with grace in your hearts, Colossians 3:16. I will sing praise, Hebrews 2 and verse 12. Is any cheerful? Let him sing psalms, James 5, verse 13. Now that's all the New Testament says about singing. It doesn't say anything about making music. It doesn't say anything about horns, trumpets. It doesn't say anything about other kinds of instruments. It just says sing. Every passage in the New Testament says sing. And really, if we respect what God said, that's what we do. Because that's all He said. He didn't say anything about silver trumpets, and He didn't say anything about the instruments that David authorized and had people to use in the temple itself. And so God authorized singing. Now what I want to do in the rest of the time is use or refer to the arguments that are used in defense of the use of instruments of music in worship. And all this is coming from Mr. Price's book. He made excellent responses to the excuses that people make to use instrumental music in worship. The Greek word solo. A lot of people have used that word, or used that argument, that the Greek word solo authorizes the use of instrumental music in worship. Well, Thayer defines solo as to pluck off, put out, pull out, cause to vibrate by touching, to twang the strings of a musical instrument. In the New Testament, to sing a hymn, to celebrate praises to God in song. And so the word solo changed in its meaning like many words do. And when you use those words, they change in meaning. For example, sometimes the words in English change. 1 Peter 3 and verse 21, baptism is the answer of a good conscience toward God. Answer has changed in meaning in the years. It means appeal, not answer as we use it means a response. But in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 21, the word translated answer means appeal. It's baptism that we appeal to God for a good conscience. It's not a response to a good conscience. It's the appeal for a good conscience. And so it is with the word solo. First, it meant to pluck or to pull out. If a person had a beard and wanted to pluck it out, you soloed it. If you got mad with your husband and pulled his hair out, you soloed him. Plucking, pulling out. That's what it meant. Then it meant to cause to vibrate by touching. Then to twang the strings of a musical instrument. It meant all those things. So which one of those are we going to do in worship? Pull hair or play an instrument? We don't do either one. Why? Because in the New Testament it didn't mean either one of those. In the New Testament it meant to celebrate the praises of God in song. That's all it meant. By the way, I have a notebook that Brother Puckett made when he had a debate on instrumental music. And I think I should have that. Somebody wants to do me a favor sometime and retype that. My sister typed it for me. I've never come across an argument that he didn't cover in that notebook. And I think really it needs to be widely distributed. I don't know whether anybody's done it or not, but I have that. And all through the years, I mean, any one of these arguments you want to talk about, he has given all the scholarship on it and all the argument and the responses to it. And he's done it on the word solo. And there's just no reason at all to believe that the word solo approves of use of instrumental music. In fact, the word solo is just a verb of action. It doesn't tell you what you solo. First, it meant to solo the hair, pull out your hair. A carpenter who pulls the string and leaves a mark, that's soloing. But the word solo doesn't tell you what you pull or what you twang. You have to learn that from some other source, like the Greek word baptize. Baptize doesn't tell you what you're baptized in. It just means immerse. Well, immerse in what? I was talking to one person several years ago about John 3 and verse 5, that we must be born of the water and of the Spirit. And she asked me, said, well, what does water mean in the passage? Well, my smarty response was, I guess if it doesn't mean water, it might mean chocolate milk. Well, if water doesn't mean water, what does it mean? She said, oh, it means Spirit. Well, I said, well, what does Spirit mean then? Born of the water and the Spirit? But Jesus saying you have to be born of the Spirit of the Spirit? That doesn't make any sense. But what I'm saying is, to be baptized just tells you the action, immerse. It doesn't tell you in what you are immersed. You may be immersed in chocolate milk. You may be immersed in water. You might be immersed in something else. But anyway, the verb does not tell you the object in which you are immersed. And the same with the Greek word solo. It doesn't tell you what the instrument is. You have to learn that from other source. So what do you solo? The hair, the carpenter string, the harp strings, or the heart? When we sing with the vocal cords and we sing with a heart, what are we doing? We're soloing. Well, what is it that we're supposed to do in the New Testament? We're to make melody with the heart to God. And so that tells us the instrument. Mr. Price said, the church fathers vehemently rejected the use of musical instruments in the worship of the church. These same men, listen, were masters in the Greek language. The early church fathers, those who did the writings early, and I'm talking about from about 140 on, where he quoted the writers and leaders in the church that wrote, all of them were Greek scholars. And the Greeks did not introduce instrumental music in their worship. If it's in the Word, why didn't the people who were Greek scholars know to put it in there? Well, the reason is it's not in the Word. Never was in the Word. The Orthodox Church still does not use it in their worship. because the regulative principle that he's talking about here, you must have authority for it, did not have it in the New Testament. And so they didn't do it. Then another argument is, it's just an aid to singing. Well, my question is, why is it played when nobody's singing? When we were in Dothan, I went with a fellow that I was trying to study with, and he said, Frank, you convinced me that you're right, and if I went to the Baptist church, they'd convince me they're right, and if I went somewhere else, they'd convince me they're right. And so, how do I know what is right? I said, go and find out. I said, in fact, I'll go with you. And so one day, there was one of the big Baptist churches close to us having a revival, and I called him. I said, you ready to go to the Baptist church? He said, yeah. I said, come on, we'll go tonight. And we went. And they had a French horn and organ duet. Nobody was singing at all. It was just a horn and an organ duet. Nobody sang. That's not aiding singing, because nobody is singing. In fact, Mr. Price said, singing and playing musical instruments are two entirely different acts. Each can be performed independent of the other. And everybody knows that's true. You can play and not sing. You can sing and not play. They're two separate acts completely. They're both music, but one of them is vocal, the other is instrumental. And so singing and playing are two separate things altogether. A songbook or PowerPoint is an aid. When we sing out of a songbook, what did we do? We didn't sing in book. We sang. When we sing looking at the words on a PowerPoint, or if you mimeograph them and hand them out or whatever, what do? We just sang. What did the Bible say? It said sing. We haven't done another kind of music. Just like the containers in the Lord's Supper, for example. We put the bread in a plate, pass it around. Where's the Bible say put it in a plate? It doesn't. When you eat the bread out of a plate, what have you done? You ate the bread. You didn't eat the bread in the plate. You just did what God said to do, break the bread. And you break the bread, you ate the bread. How about the containers for fruit of the vine? Same thing. Some brethren get all bent out of shape out of the containers for the fruit of the vine. We don't drink the container. We drink the contents. And when it says they drank the cup, they didn't drink the container. They drank the contents. And so when you drink the fruit of the vine, what you do? Exactly what Jesus said. Drink the fruit of the vine. And so the thing that the bread is in or the fruit of the vine is in has nothing to do with a different kind of thing being done in the communion. Just like when you sing out of a book. You haven't done two different things. Or if you sing from memory. Or if you sing, as I said, in PowerPoint. You haven't done two different things. You just did what the Lord said. That is, you have sung praises to God. Another argument that is used is that there are harps in heaven. I want to read you Revelation chapter 5 and verse 8. And we're going to read some other passages in Revelation in just a minute too. But in chapter 5 and verse 8, John wrote, now when he had taken a scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. In chapter 14 and in verse 2, the same writer says, and I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters and like the voice of a loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. You see, they got harps in heaven. And so if it's good enough for heaven, it's good enough for the church, isn't it? If it's good enough for heaven, it's certainly good enough for earth. And so you got harps in heaven. And so we can have them in the church. I like Mr. Price's response to this. He said, number one, the book of Revelation is in figurative language. These things were signified, symbolized to John. A sign is not a sign of itself. A sign is a sign of something else. And so when he's using this, you need to understand that a major part of the book of Revelation is in symbolic language, not literal. And he pointed out the same verse in chapter 5 and verse 8 says that they had bowls of incense in heaven. Furthermore, in chapter 8 and verse 3, he says, Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar, and he was given much incense that he should offer it upon the golden altar which was before the throne. They had a gold altar in heaven. Does that mean we can have gold altars in the church? In chapter 16 and in verse 1, "Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, 'Go and pour out your bowls of wrath, or the wrath of God on the earth.'" Do we have bowls of wrath to pour out on people in the church? I hope not. We do have some wrathful brethren sometimes, but that's another subject. We don't have bowls of wrath. They had lambs. They had horses in heaven, different colored horses. Does that mean in the church we should have those things? No. That's symbolical and not literal. And I like this point that Mr. Price made in page 202. He said there's no marrying or giving in marriage in heaven either. If this example of heaven becomes our rule on earth, then we would cease to exist after one generation. What would happen if we didn't marry or give in marriage in the church? Well, just about wipe us out, wouldn't it? You see, this is things that are said to be in heaven. And he went ahead and said, by the way, that if God chooses to have a literal organ in heaven, we'll just have to wait till we get there to use it. He didn't put it in the church. Now, that attitude toward authority ought to get him over some of his other error, I think, but it doesn't seem to do that. But that is excellent, true reasoning. If the Lord didn't put it in the church, we shouldn't put it in the church. And only the things that he had said. Well, what about a pitch pipe? He dealt with that too. Page 206 and 207, some brethren don't even understand what Mr. Price understood. He said the pitch pipe is used before the hymn actually begins. And it remains silent throughout the entire act of singing. We don't sing in pitch pipe. We sing. It doesn't do anything while we're singing. If a musical instrument is used for the same purpose as the pitch pipe, namely, to set the pitch with a single note before the hymn begins, we will have no objection to its use. Doesn't make much sense to bring in a piano to hit one note when you can get a little tuning fork or pitch pipe to do it. But he said if that's all they use it for, we'd have no objection to it. Why? Because you didn't sing in pitch, you sang on pitch. That's all you did. Or sing off pitch. Either way, it's singing, isn't it? And so he says it's a simple thing. What about the history of instrumental music? And this is from a history of the Christian Church by Philip Schaff, who said the use of organs in churches is ascribed to Pope Vitalian 657 to 672. The Greek church disapproves the use of organs. The Latin church introduced it pretty generally, but not without protest of eminent men, so that even in the Council of Trent, which was in 1545 to 1563, a motion was made, though not carried, to prohibit the organ, at least in the Mass. And this, brethren, wasn't all the Catholic churches all started using organs in 670 about A.D. One church used an organ. Generally, then, it spread. 800 years later, they were still arguing about it. Why? Because they hadn't done that before. Who introduced it? The Greek-speaking church in the East? No. The Latin-speaking church in the West. The Roman Catholic, not the Greek Catholic. The Greek Catholic, the Orthodox Church, does not use it in any country except this one. And they only use organs in this country. They don't use other kinds of instrumental music, by the way. The Reformers generally opposed instrumental music. Martin Luther said, the organ in worship is an ensign of Baal. John Calvin said, the Papists, referring to the Pope, therefore have foolishly borrowed this, as well as many other things, from the Jews. John Wesley said, I have no objection to instruments of music in our chapels, providing they're neither heard nor seen. And we could quote others too that said the same kind of thing. Most of the Reformation leaders opposed instrumental music in worship. A lot of people think that the Baptist churches always use instrumental music. The greatest Baptist preacher, I guess, that ever lived was in London, England, Charles Spurgeon. Preached to a congregation of 10,000 people, he never used instrumental music in worship. I've talked to people who had been Baptists, and they remembered. This one woman I talked to several years ago in Dothan, in fact, said, I remember when they introduced the first piano. People think they've always done it. Well, they didn't either. The historical evidence against the use of instrumental music is simply overwhelming. Well, what's the conclusion? The best argument for instrumental music in worship is what? I like it. That the best argument that's ever been made for instrumental music in worship. I like it. In fact, I was talking to a man in Richmond, Virginia when I was a young preacher. And every argument he made, I answered it. And he got through. He says, well, I don't care. I like it anyway. So we're going to do what we like, or we're going to do what has been authorized. Well, what if I like steak in the Lord's Supper? Same reasoning. I like it. And if I like it, then I can do it. Colossians 3 and verse 17 says, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to the God the Father through Him. Our worship must be in the name of the Lord. That means by His authority. And if there's no authority for it, we can't do it if we're going to act in the name of the Lord. There's a little story I read that I want to tell you in conclusion. And it was entitled, Willie Got the Job. And the story was that this man was going to hire a young man to work for him. And the story didn't tell what kind of work it was. But he was just going to give a little story to four boys. And whoever gave the best answer would get the job. Whoever listened carefully and gave the answer that he was looking for would get the job. The story is that a farmer went to the barn to shoot an owl. When he shot, the gun backfired and set the hay on fire. Burned his barn, burned the hay, burned his cows, burned him. His wife came out to try to help him, and she got burned seriously and died herself. Now, what do you see in this story? So the first boy said, well, sure is a sad thing that your wife died, but you can remember that she died trying to save your life. And that'd be a wonderful thing for you to remember, that she died trying to save your life. Another one said, well, it sure is a great loss for all those animals that you had in the barn, and you went out there for an owl, and you end up losing all your animals. That's a tragic loss. Another said, well, you know, your barn, you know, you lost your whole barn for an owl. And that just doesn't make any sense. And it's just tragedy. That something like that happened. Well, Willie came in. And the man told him the same story. And Willie said, well, I have one question. Did the farmer hit the owl? Would you have gotten the job? Willie did. What did the farmer go to the barn to do? To shoot the owl. The question is, did he hit the owl? What did we come here to do this morning? To worship God. My question is, did we do it? Did we accomplish what we came together to do? Willie got the job because he stayed focused on what the farmer went to do. We have to stay focused on what we come together to do. We come together to worship God. Do we do it? That's the question. We sing praises to God. Why? Because that's what God told us to do. And we're to do it in spirit and in truth. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Christ, we want to extend to you the Lord's invitation. If you need to be baptized into Christ, or if you need to be restored to the Lord, we invite you to let that be known while we stand together and while we sing.